Idaho is now in session pursuant to law.
Be seated, thank you. Good morning once again and welcome back to the Idaho Supreme Court meeting today at Brigham Young University, Idaho, for our second hearing of the day on June 14, 2023, a case entitled Farms LLC versus Eisen. We again note for the record that Justice Brody is absent and excused today and will fully participate by listening to the recording of this hearing and meeting with us to convene and discuss this case after oral argument. The appellant in this matter are Ralph and Paula Eisen. They are represented by Michelle Points. And the respondent and a cross appellant, Farms LLC, represented by Stephen Taggart. Counsel, good morning. Thank you, Ms. Points, for making the cross state to be here with us. Any preliminary matters before we begin? Very well, Ms. Points, you may proceed.
Good morning, Madam Speaker. May I please support holding a brief summary of the applicable facts and then jump right into it. As I've been in front of you several times, I'm usually brief in my argument. At issue here started with Ralph and Paula Eisen having ownership and hundreds of acres of property here in Bonneville County. And they had to exercise a deed in lieu of foreclosure, and then they leased back the property. What came to fruition in this litigation is the farms. It was the purchaser of the deed in lieu, subsequent purchaser of the deed in lieu, and Eisen's leased the property back. Then Eisen's filed for bankruptcy. During the course of that bankruptcy, Eisen filed a motion to lift the automatic stay that was in place so they could pursue matters related to the lease and the unlawful detainer action. And also during the term of that bankruptcy, they purchased certain claims with third-party creditors. The explanation given at trial was that they purchased those claims so they could have more votes in the then Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceeding and the plan that the Eisens were going to be governed by. That bankruptcy was ultimately denied. It was converted to a seventh, and it was denied in June of 2019. There are three sets of claims that the farms subsequently brought in 2021. Claim number one is for breach of contract, breach of the lease. The second was for a holdover payment that were due under the lease. And the third had to do with the assigned claims. We had a court trial back in December of 2022, and the court dismissed counts one and two based on the statute of limitations, and they awarded closer to $1.3 million on count three, which would be assigned claims. It's the basis of that appeal. That's the basis of our appeal here, is the counts under claim three, the assigned claims. During the course of the pre-litigation briefing and prior to the evidentiary trial proceeding and following the trial, Farms took the position that the controlling statute was 108C under 11 of the U.S. Code, and that provides that if the statute of limitations didn't expire before the bankruptcy was filed, but expired during the term of the bankruptcy, then the movement gets 30 days extension of time after the bankruptcy is closed to file their claim. And again, that was in June of 2019, and Farms didn't file their case in Bonneville County until 2021. I think, you know, there's been a lot of reading about the substance and the application of the various statutes at issue, but I think, you know, when I was making that long trek here yesterday in a car. You know, sometimes in these cases we get caught up in a lot of the substance of the law, which is, of course, what we're here for today, but, you know, reading the court's decision, here in front of me, I read it again this morning, there's a place where the district court said applicable law. And not one place in that decision does it reference the U.S. Code that's applicable to claims and bankruptcy actions. Nowhere. It's as if we never made the argument, and that was the basis of our defense to claim three, that there's no dispute by the farms that those statute of limitations expire during the pendency of the bankruptcy. So I don't think this falls within the body of cases from this court that says this is a harmless error, we would have reached the same decision, you know, the no harm, no foul. You know, the court may have got it wrong, but, you know, looking at everything, the outcome would be the same. This isn't one of those cases. Because if you don't remand this case, you're putting yourself in the shoes of the finder of fact and the concluder of law. Because this decision doesn't address the application of the statute that governs what you should do with the claim. Now, we cited in briefly...
Counsel, I'm a little confused by your argument. What facts are we being asked to find here today? I thought we were just being asked to affirm or reverse the district court on their, its legal analysis of the statute of limitations.
Well, the standard of review is, does the evidence support the findings of fact? Okay, I'll give you that. Maybe it's not a finding of fact issue. But do the findings of fact support a conclusion of law? Absent in this opinion is the conclusion of law as it pertains to the applicable code. So maybe you're not standing in the shoes of the finders of fact, but you certainly are standing in the shoes of the concluder of law.
Which is what we do with an appellate court, is we conclude what the law is. So it seems to me part of the confusion, at least that I have, and maybe it was somewhat below too, is there's a lot of terms that seem to me are being used interchangeably that maybe have distinct meanings. I mean, we've talked about grace periods, we've talked about tolling, we've talked about staying.
Yes.
In this context, could you talk about how those terms are applicable to the decision or the choice of law we have to make today?
Yes, absolutely. So in the appellate brief, we cited two cases throughout the country, and I think the case that summarizes them best is the Atlantis versus Brandeis Infill case, 7-3-1-0-6-7. And that case went into very, very discreet detail about what the language in 11108C means. And I'll go, so you're right, there is a lot of talk about staying, tolling. 11 U.S.C. 108C is not a tolling statute, and I don't think the farms disputes that. But what language comes up is, what is a specific suspension statute? That's what the issue here. Farms is taking the position that 5234, which is a plain Jane outcome. I mean, I've never even seen it cited in a Supreme Court case in this state. It's a plain Jane. If there's an injunction that stops the clock, then you don't count the days in the middle. But when you look to 11108C, which the district court doesn't apply, when you go to the Atlantic case, it says 108C, when you look at the legislative history of it, which is applicable to statute of limitations that expire during the pendency of the bankruptcy. It says the legislative history makes evident that 108C1 refers only to special suspensions that are found in bankruptcy provisions, such as the Internal Revenue Code. Special suspension statutes, one that specifically deal with bankruptcy states.
To be clear, the suspension we're talking about, though, isn't the suspension of the time to sue. We're talking about a suspension of deadlines that are applicable under federal and state laws, correct? But isn't that what Islandis says? I'm quoting from Islandis. It merely incorporates suspensions of deadlines that are expressly provided in other federal and state statutes.
That's absolutely correct. And there's special suspension statutes. Not your plain Jane 5234.
When you say plain Jane, is that synonymous with plain and unambiguous, though? And it seems to me we're tasked to just apply some statutory construction, and in all the briefing from both sides, I'm still wrestling with, okay, if 5234 plainly applies, then why does the language that the prohibition during the stay does not count against the time to bring the action? That seems pretty clear to me. And why don't we apply that? And why are we forced into, this was in bankruptcy, but it's not anymore. So why is 234 just plain Jane, therefore it doesn't apply?
Well, I think it's not specific to bankruptcy, and I think the holding in Atlantis support the proposition that it has to be specific to bankruptcy. I think it says that because it refers to IRS codes and those akin to them that have special suspensions during the pendency of the bankruptcy. And we have
But Auslandis also refers to state statutes that suspend the time. And
I absolutely agree with that. It does. It says state and federal statutes.
And so where would you have a state statute that is specific to federal bankruptcy law that would suspend some cause of action under federal bankruptcy law?
Well,
I'm not sure how the state could legislate in that area.
I think it absolutely could. I mean, if you have a statute that says, you know, if you have competing claims or if you're pursuing a claim or if you're in litigation and there's a bankruptcy filed, you don't count the days.
And I'm struggling with why 5234 doesn't cover that, because it talks about a statutory prohibition that stays the case. And when I look at 11 U.S.C. 362, the bankruptcy stay, it stays the case. And then when I look at 11 U.S.C. Section 108, it talks about if applicable non-bankruptcy law provides a time period for commencing an action, and the period has not expired before the date of filing the petition, which it hadn't expired here before the date of filing the petition, then that time frame for filing doesn't expire until the later of the end of the period, including any suspension of such period occurring under non-bankruptcy law, or the 30 days. And so I'm struggling with how 5234 didn't apply to suspend the time period for filing this action, given that the automatic bankruptcy stay suspended pursuing any sort of action.
I think if you parse it apart, I don't think there's any dispute. Just taking 11108C by itself without inserting the suspension language here, there's no dispute that those statute of limitations expired during dependency of the bankruptcy stay.
Well, but I think Farms does dispute that, because Farms says it was suspended under 5234. So I think Farms' argument, as I read it, is this did not expire during the pendency of the proceeding because it was stayed, it was suspended.
I understand that, and I'm just trying to parse it apart without the suspension language. So we take the first step. Not looking at the suspension statute as a mouthful, it expired during the pendency of the bankruptcy stay. So then you have the Farms argument. Well, take us to 5234. It doesn't have the word suspend, and it's not an unambiguous statute. I mean, so
are you suggesting that 5234 doesn't apply to these facts?
Yes.
And that's the gist of your argument?
Yes.
And then you have to be more specific in how they crafted 5234 for it to apply.
Or crafted a separate statute that applied more specifically. Because in Idaho, there are statutes that carve out special circumstances. For instance, as you're aware, I do a lot of medical malpractice cases. And there's a specific statute that says, But if the statute of limitations expires during the time that it's during pre-litigation, that's okay. You have 30 days after the pre-litigation period to file your claim. There's nothing that prevents the Idaho legislature from saying, hey, you know, just to be clear, if you file a bankruptcy and the statute of limitations expires during the pendency of the bankruptcy, those days in bankruptcy don't count. Because if you look at 5234, it's a confusing statute. When the commencement of an action is stayed by injunction, or statutory prohibition, the time of the continuance of the injunction is not part of the time limited to commence the action.
So why isn't a bankruptcy stay within the following the injunction in the order language of the statute?
Because it doesn't use the word suspend, and it's confusing. It seems to read that you already commenced an action. When the commencement of an action is stayed, it seems to assume that it's already commenced.
Well, commencement means beginning. So if the beginning is stayed, that doesn't necessarily mean it's already been filed, does it?
Not necessarily. I'm just not saying it's not entirely clear. It doesn't use the word suspend. And I don't think it's a specific suspension statute contemplated by 108C1, given the legislative history.
Well, and what's interesting is 108C1 doesn't say specific suspension statute. It says any suspension of such period.
Yeah, but when you go back to the language of Atlanta, and I'm looking at footnotes 6 and 7, when you talk about the legislative history, if there's any ambiguity with reference to suspension in this statute, it's cleared up by explaining provisions of legislative history. And it refers only to the legislative history, not the language of the statute itself, but with reference to the legislative history. It only refers to special suspensions that are found in non-bankruptcy provisions, such as the IRS, which has a provision that specifically deals with special suspensions.
Right, but we only get to the legislative history if we determine the language of 108C1 is ambiguous. And I'm struggling with how including any suspension of such period is ambiguous.
I'm not saying that that's ambiguous. I'm making an argument that 5234 has some ambiguity to it, and that it does not fall within the confines of a specific suspension statute.
And my argument is 108C1 doesn't say a specific suspension statute. It says any suspension. And so when 5234 says the period is stayed, a stay is a suspension. I'm struggling with how a stay is not a suspension.
I think that the words stay and suspension are mutually exclusive. Because stay doesn't contemplate you don't count the days. Farms is making an argument that if they get credit for the days in bankruptcy, stay doesn't necessarily mean that. I think the terms are mutually exclusive. If you have something that says suspend, you stop counting. When you have the word stay, you just say you can't sue this person or you can't continue an action. The terms don't mean the same thing.
Help me understand then, you know, I was not a big time practitioner in bankruptcy law, but my understanding of reading Section 5234 and 108 of the Bankruptcy Code, the purpose of these kind of statutes is to prevent a debtor from running out the clock against a creditor's claim by filing bankruptcy and then not giving them credit for the time in which they are actually stopped. There's an automatic stay telling them they cannot take legal action, therefore we're not going to hold that time against them and say, oh, we ran out the clock, you can't bring anything. Isn't that the intent of these statutes? And if so, how does the interpretation that you're giving not contradict that intent?
I don't think it contradicts it at all, because 108C gives the creditor 30 more days. I mean, that could be the purpose of this statute. And I don't disagree with your interpretation. I'm not a bankruptcy practitioner either. But I think the purpose of 108C1 is that if you've got a debtor that's running out the time on the clock, creditor, we're giving you 30 days after it expires.
How is it fair if you run 6 months off the clock or a year off the clock and say, we're going to make it up to you by giving you 30 days of grace? How is that fair?
Well, the U.S. legislature thought it was fair.
Congress, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, the people that, the lawmakers that enacted 108C1 obviously contemplated, you know, that exact scenario.
Well, and what about our legislators here in Idaho that said, no, no, we're not going to let debtors run out the clock against their creditors in this way?
Then make a statute that says that. This statute doesn't say that.
Okay, and so the deficiency in the statute, in your mind, is that it doesn't use the word bankruptcy in it, or what?
It doesn't use the word bankruptcy. It doesn't use the word to suspend. It doesn't support the farm's argument that those days that the stay was in place, they get credit for.
Doesn't when the legislature draft the statute that's generally worded suggest that their intent was to give it broad applicability?
I mean, I don't disagree with that. That the legislative history applicable to 108C says specific suspension statute. What if you have a, you know, overbroad, you know, statute that says generically, I would say, stay, injunction, statutory prohibition, it doesn't fall within the confines of what fits into 108C, and it was an error of the district court not to have this discussion or this analysis or even a reference to 108C. In its decision. That's the error. That's what's an error, and I think that it puts this court in the situation of not a standard of review, but as a decision maker, because the underlying court made no analysis, reference, or conclusion of law as to the applicability of 108C.
So if you have your best day in court here today and we give you the relief you want, your suggestion, you want us to remand this and tell the district court, consider 108 before you make your decision.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Sir?
May it please the court. Before I begin, I have to take a second and talk about our surroundings just briefly. Because I will tell the court, having just been in front of you recently, that this is less intimidating than you. This is far behind you, this is a little bit more. As court noted, I represent Farms LLC, who was a creditor in the Eisen bankruptcy that began at the end of July 2015. The Eisens were neither discharged at the end of 2019. And that's the period that is the suspension here we're talking about. There's a couple of things I just want to clarify just briefly. The question is the purchase claims, the count through claims. The reason one does it, if the court understands the context, Farms LLC was the largest secured creditor in the Eisen bankruptcy. It was a Chapter 11 originally. And the reason that you buy claims is for purposes of being able to vote by classes in order to protect your interests. It's a very common strategy in bankruptcy, and that's what was going on there. It's not exclusively the reason that we buy it. So the second issue was the question about the Chapter 7. There was a comment made that the Chapter 7 was somehow dismissed. It was not. The Chapter 7 was completed. Once the case converted, it was completed. The only issue was Farms didn't get paid at least times.
What was the reason for the conversion from 11 to 7?
The conversion was that you could not confirm Chapter 11. And I'll leave it on in the history. It's not part of our development state court. They took over the debate, proposed several plans. They were unsuccessful in confirmation. There was a competing plan proposed by Farms that we believe was in a position of being confirmed and converted to avoid that. I hope that answers it.
Thank you.
Justice's question. The fundamental part of the court has the court that I'm going to go a different direction.
Can I just back on? I'm sorry. You said that Chapter 7 was completed, but it wasn't completed successfully then?
Until one defines success. So there was a trustee appointed, Sam Hawkins from Public Health. And Sam resolved the remaining claims. And just a slight bit of background, it ended up with Farms LLC with the property that they had their interest in, but there was, and also Farms paid off the other creditors, but with the ability to pursue these claims. So that was the gist of it. Anyway, the real issue before the court, the first issue is really two issues, and I think we'll get this signpost to you. The first issue is this question of statutory interaction between the bankruptcy code and the state law. And then the second issue we need to get to is the impact of the lifting of the bankruptcy state. That's the second big issue. And so I want to deal with both those, but let me deal with the first, which is considered the court's time and the previous argument. The question is, fundamentally, is what happens in Idaho when you have two things occurring. One is you have first a series of claims that derive from the 2013, 2014, and 2015 period, that these are the purchase claims, where you have bankruptcies filed on July 31st of 2015. And then what happens at that point, of course, is the application of 11 U.S.C. 362 of the automatic stay. The automatic stay in subpart A is very specific. It says all actions against the debtor, in this case debtors, or property is prohibited. Flat out. That is, you know, the ultimate stay, so the one everyone discusses. But the interesting part about that is how does that play out under state law? And there's no doubt that we're dealing with two provisions in Idaho that deal with contractual claims. One is for oral claims, 4 years, and the other is for written claims, which is 5 years. But the issue then comes into play is the question of the interaction of 108C and 5-234. And the issue comes down to 108C. So let me just go back to 108 and what it does. What 108C does is it says, the latter of is the deadline to take action with respect to a lawsuit, as long as that right has not expired pre-bankruptcy. There's nothing before the court that indicates any of these so-called purchase claims had expired before bankruptcy. So that's what gets us into 108C. Then the issue is two provisions. It's the latter, and that's the point I want to emphasize. The latter, you have, basic credit in our sense, has the latter of either the time period under state law or federal law, or 30 days after, in this case, when the discharge is known, which is that 2019 date. And so the question is the latter. And so that would go back to 5-234.
Before we get there, one of the main points of contention brought up by appellant was that the district judge didn't properly analyze 108 in its decision, and we need to tell that judge to do that before we weigh in on the issue. Do you want to respond?
I know, Your Honor. It is fair to say, you know, the reason I crossed the table is there were some problems in the analysis, and I think it's, let's be blunt, the issue is, I'm a big fan of Judge David. I will lay that out. I'm a big fan of it. But the reality is, this was a complicated issue, the interplay of the federal piece, the bankruptcy piece, and the state piece. And frankly, I don't think the decision was as precise as it should have been. But this court has the ability to, you know, affirm a decision that's the right decision.
Did the attorneys that supposedly have more knowledge in bankruptcy law properly advise him through their briefing of these issues?
Absolutely. The court looks at the record. We'll see both the oral arguments presented at the last trial. And also, in both pre-trial I'll let the court know there was an issue of what the position was of Isons both before and during the trial. But post-trial briefs, I think, make it abundantly clear. It's a very consistent position taken today. So that's the point of me.
So when 108 then talks about suspension of deadlines, is that the same thing as statute of limitations?
It is, because it's to bring actions. That's what the statutory language says. It's that bringing actions. And so actions, of course, is the whole purpose of statute of limitations. What's the deadline to bring an action? And so then the question you get into is, what does 5-234 do? Well, it says, if the commencement, which is the filing of an action, is stayed by an injunction or statutory prohibition. Well, 362A is a statutory prohibition by definition. And it goes on, of course, to talk about the implication of that is that time is that is not part of the time you live it. And that's why the issue is here, is 108C1 is the applicable provision that pulls it in. And I'm going to tell the court there is a good way to look at this, because we don't have Idaho case law on this, but we have some very good guidance on it. And it's the case that I gave the court. It's a BAP decision from the Ninth Circuit BAP. This is the bankruptcy of Paul Pyle. By the way, Judge Havas was the chief judge of that for many years. In the Ninth Circuit, BAP, in the case of Brown versus Gaunt III, is a very clear analysis of exactly this issue. By looking at the California statute, that guess what, is the same as Idaho Code 5-234, the word is identical. And what it does is it goes through and gives the analysis I just gave the court. And so I think if the appellate court that deals with bankruptcy issues can trace through the implication of a suspension statute like we have, which I think is what 5-234 is, I think that court can adopt the same analysis. And I think it's consistent with other cases that are coming to court. For instance, there was reference to the Henry Silva decision, which was one of Judge Pappas' decisions back in 97. And it's interesting in that decision because what he saw there is a judgment that basically goes for 10 years in California. And then you have the bankruptcy that it imposes. And the question was whether 108C applied to AC2, the 30-day provision, or not. And Judge Pappas said it didn't. Because remember, the latter of it, he said, well, that 30-day, because of where the discharge was going, would have started here, but the 10 years of the judgment was over here. That's consistent with what the analysis I just gave the court. And so that decision actually stands to the same proposition. That the issue is the latter, whether it's the state suspension in this case, statutes, which is 5-234, or the 30 days.
If the suspension works the way you suggest, what is the purpose of a grace period then?
The grace period is basically a catch-all. That if it expires, remember, the issue you only get 1OCC if you have, at the point of filing, you're not past your time limits. So let's assume, for instance, there's a really interesting case in front of the Husband case. I can't remember the circuit, I want to say 7 or 8. But it was a case where it involved basically a plane wreck, and there was a question whether under Missouri law would apply. Well, it was actually more complicated than that because it was that of the Warsaw Convention, and a treaty applied. And so there was an argument made that, well, let's look at the Missouri law, and then, well, the problem was there was no suspension statute in Missouri. They didn't have a 5-234. And the court, in the direction, was actually the treaty that applied. But my point being is that if we get into these, the question is, you've got to get in the door by not having expiration before the bankruptcy. And if it's inside the bankruptcy, the expiration, I don't think we have an expiration there because of the suspension statute, the 5-234. But if it occurs then at least you've got to catch all the 30 days after once the state disappears.
So then help me. A question I asked Ms. Points is we use terms like tolling and staying and suspending, and I'm hearing from your argument that they're generally synonymous. My concern is that these might be terms of art that have a little more nuanced, specific meaning.
The issue the court gets into is a fair one, but I think the language of 108C, particularly C1, is broad enough, as Justice Sullivan had indicated, to encompass what this power that is saying. So I don't think that's an issue here. And I think it's consistent with 5-234. I just don't think we have an issue there. I think there may be cases out there where that may be an issue. I don't think it's one there. Okay? With that, if the court doesn't have any questions on this topic, I want to move to the other one. That's the other element of the room. The question is, there was a motion made by Farms that was granted by Judge Pappas in October of 2015. There was a motion for relief from the state. The question is, what did it do? Well, it's interesting to look at the order. The order says that the state is looking with respect to movement, which is Farms, and also with respect to, it's also looking with respect to the property, which is the property that they were seeking for eviction. What happened is Farms asked for a relief because we want to be able to evict ISIS off the property they're leasing, and we also want to have a claim that's completed on the lease, and we'll put it in as a claim of bankruptcy. It's called a usury claim. But that didn't get, that as I indicated didn't get paid. So the issue is it certainly didn't allow ISIS to sue personally. And the court can see that the court goes to 362 itself. 362B is where you ask for state relief. It only deals with property. There's four provisions. Every one of them mentioned property. They don't mention suing the debtor. To sue the debtor, you have to go to 362C. And C1 says, well, you get there if you have property that's no longer part of the state, or you use the D provisions. But the other is if bankruptcy is closed, dismissed, or discharge is denied. That did not occur in this case. and El Camino Medellin. And so my point being is that happens. We did this, Dave Saber could not allow us to sue them for the supposed foreign language. That's not what the legal is asking. That's not what his order says.
And so my struggle with that, I'm trying to understand. I understand the unlawful detainer part. Let's get him off the property. I'm struggling with how the lifting of the stay to liquidate the damage award and include it in a proof of claim, how that lifting wouldn't also encompass the claims raised in this case.
Well, the issue is this, you know, remember, this is a lawsuit to make Bison's personally liable. That's what these were, personally liable. The leases, Camelot 2, and the third-party claims. And so that's different than in the bankruptcy, calculating what the amount is of damage for the leases, and then having a claim in bankruptcy. It's a claim
against the estate.
It's a claim against the estate. That's what it's about. It's called an administrative claim. Because of the estate, it's settled out of the estate. That's what happened. So my point is, I think that error, it was an error on the part of the state court judge on this, and I think he needs to go back. You know, he had the evidence how to calculate what those lease claims were, and he needs to go back and do that.
So it was an imprecise decision by the state court judge, imprecise to the degree that he erred as a matter of law then by making the decision he did as to the first two counts.
Correct, Your Honor. Yes. I mean, it's kind of an odd position because I think he got three right, but I think it's inconsistent fundamentally with one.
As I read his decision, he was relying on the order from 2015 to say, hey, look, you had time in 2016-17 on to go for count 1 and 2. You failed. But really, that was solely against the property, and the personal claims didn't, in your argument, arise until 2019 when you could go against them personally.
Correct, Your Honor. And, you know, and there's another aspect to that. I think it's just a nuance coming. And it has to do with, you know, the stay, a lot of people think the stay is either there or not. But it's more nuanced than that, because that Section B of 362 allows it to be lifted for property. There's four provisions. One deals with basically your secured creditor and you're not receiving payments. That's the ground to lift it. We have a second provision that deals with, there's no equity in the property, so now you have a car that's upside down. They're not paying on credit union, and it's not necessary for them to function in bankruptcy. That's another ground. We have another one that deals with single asset real estate companies. That's when you have a hotel, for instance. That's the surplus. The debtor owns a hotel. That's the only asset they have. There's a special provision on that. And there's a fourth that could be engine fraud involving the loaning creditor. But there's nothing about suing them personally. You can't, in a state or motion, ask to sue them personally. It just isn't there. And it never has been. Any further questions?
Sure, sir.
Thank you
very much, sir. Madam Clerk, how much time does he have remaining?
10 minutes, sir.
I just have a couple of points just to read in response to counsel's arguments. There is one case in Idaho, it's a federal case, Judge Young, it's the In Re Silva case that we cited in our briefing. And in that case, and it's the only case that cites, there's other cases that cite the 108C, but the only one that's really applicable here is, in Silva, there was an issue, it was a dispute between a husband and wife, and the wife had a judgment recorded in California. Husband filed for bankruptcy. The bankruptcy was done, and she didn't file a judgment within the 30-day time frame or renewal of the judgment within the 30-day time frame. Now, arguably, it wasn't a case where the expiration came during the pendency of the bankruptcy, but it came after, but there wasn't any finding in that case that they get credit for the time in bankruptcy. And counsel made arguments in briefing, well, maybe they just didn't raise the issue. I didn't go back and order the case because it was pre-PACER, so it's not like you can just roll it up. But I think it's important. I mean, following counsel's line of argument earlier, it just matters if the court gets it right. There was no finding in there that the wife should have got credit for the time during the bankruptcy case. To address the Brown case, the BAP decision that has the statute that has the same language as the Idaho case, I would have to tell you that this court is not bound to follow California law, but I do want to raise the issue that it was in dicta. The Brown was addressing an argument in a reopened bankruptcy case, and the crux of the decision was, does the discharge injunction toll the statute of limitations? It was a bankruptcy that was filed and then closed and then reopened, and so it all had to do with discharge injunction, and the language used in that decision was the Browns conceded that the limitations period was told under California law while the automatic stay was in place. So I don't know that this count, and you're not bound by dicta in a California case. And
well, hold on just a second. This obviously was a case that involved California law, and we're not bound to follow California law, but this was a Ninth Circuit bankruptcy decision.
Yeah.
We're part of the Ninth Circuit. Certainly, it's very persuasive authority how a Ninth Circuit bankruptcy court interpreted a statute that's identical to an Idaho statute.
Yeah.
Shouldn't that be something we take into consideration?
It should be, but again, I believe in the Brown case, which is the only case cited from the BAP, it was dicta. That's our position. I don't disagree with you, but it was dicta. And to address the lifting of the automatic stay, the petition to lift the automatic stay, I have trouble with that because in the petition for the automatic stay to be lifted, there was a specific request to the bankruptcy court that they get to go in and do the unlawful retainer and get a money judgment to be liquidated, or alternatively, lift the stay with respect to the farms completely. And I understand counsel's argument that, you know, not personality but property, but that's the relief they sought, and that's the relief they got. And it doesn't, and the motion, nor the order, limits it in scope to personality versus property. It says the movement and the property.
So is it your position then they could have brought this same suit after that stay was lifted?
That is our position.
Personally against ISIM.
And the reason for that is because the relief they sought was any monetary judgment be liquidated, but only paid upon filing a proof of claim with the bankruptcy court. So yes, they conditioned it, but that's what they asked for and that's what they got.
But that wasn't seeking a judgment against the ISIMs personally. As I read their motion, it was seeking to liquidate what they were owed so that they could include it in their proof of claim against the bankruptcy estate.
And why we see that there's no distinction between that and the third-party settlements.
Okay.
That they had to reduce. They could have and were permitted. They were permitted to reduce them for judgments and file a proof of claim, just like the any money that would be due under that unlawful retainer action.
Thank you very much, counsel. To each of you, we appreciate your argument and time on this case. The matter is now under advisement. We'll render a decision accordingly. We'll discuss it until approximately 11:10.
All rise, please.